Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uerstein. We're broadcasting from our Vauxhall London offices again, and I have a very special guest in studio. He's my stunt double for our sister publication here in the UK, New Model Advisor, Jack Gilbert. Jack, welcome to the show, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure.
Well, today we're going to talk about how regulation is shaping advice markets in both South Africa and in the UK, and how our regulators, the FSCA in South Africa, Financial Sector Conduct Authority, and FCA, much shorter, Financial Conduct Authority in the UK, are aligned or diverging. But let's start with the basics. My listeners, or viewers in this case, don't really know much about your title. Maybe you can just tell them what you do and who you write for.
With pleasure, Ruan. So I'm the editor of New Model Advisor. This is our title for financial advisors in the UK. And yeah, the clue's in the name. We're obviously writing for a specific audience of financial advisors. There are 36,000 of them. Most of them, I think about 70 or 80% work for small businesses. Maybe more like 70% small businesses. They're small business owners. They're running their own little practices, and they're providing advice and wealth management services to retail investors, mainly retirees, people building up to retirement and then going into retirement. So that's who we write for, and we cover, I'm sure you do as well, Ruan, a broad range of topics, from pensions to regulation to tax to investments, to kind of business news around acquisitions and takeovers and what's going on in the market. So, and just trying to write interesting things for our financial advisor audience.
Absolutely. We do repurpose a lot of your copy, which my audience enjoy just as much. But let's start with a top-level review. The FSCA, the South African version, just released a 2025 to their 2028 regulatory review or plan. And financial advisors are very much on the agenda. And I'm going to read this because it's a lot of words, especially with the looming conduct of a financial institutional, or COFI for short, bill. We're treating customers fairly, or the framework thereof, will finally be introduced in South Africa of 10 years of planning and deliberations. I think the RDR is the equivalent here in the UK. So let's talk about that. What is the stance in the UK, and how far have things evolved or developed or settled since it was introduced here in 2013, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, 2013. Well, we actually have the treating customers fairly. That was one of the, our predecessor, the FSA, as it was then, the Financial Services Authority, introduced treating customers fairly, I think in 2006, although that's probably wrong. So I think it was around then. It was actually pre-RDR. So that kind of, that mantra, that edict, the treating customers fairly thing has been around for, you know, years and years in the UK, and it still comes up about, you know, various different wrongdoing, firms acting badly. You see, is this treating customers fairly? So that's been a key part of our UK regulation system for probably two decades now. But then, as you write, rightly said, yeah, in 2013 we had RDR, the Retail Distribution Review, came in, which was a huge moment for financial advisors in the UK. It effectively banned commission payments. So prior to that, advisors were going out selling funds. I mean, they weren't really advisors in many respects, because they were selling funds, but they would be paid commission by fund managers, and often you would see the funds that were charging the highest commissions would be the ones the advisors would sell. A lot of them worked for big institutions like insurers and banks, and there was quite a lot of mis-selling in that era pre-RDR because of the commission payments. So 2013, kind of post-financial crisis, there was a big push around increasing regulation in the UK, increasing the regulation on banks and, well, all sorts of financial institutions. And kind of as part of that, the Retail Distribution Review came into place in 2013. There was a lot of hand-wringing before then, a lot of negotiations with the industry and back and forth and different changes going on. But it came in January 2013, and banned commission. And yeah, it just moved to a transparent model where you had to say, I'm charging an advice fee, and then separate it out. This is the platform fee, this is the fund fee. Whereas previously you had like a bundling of charges, so there'd just be one fee and the clients would be kind of none the wiser about who's taking what share or how much is being paid in commission payments. So it was a huge moment for advisors and it did massively change things. I mean, the other thing that came in at the time was a huge a move to more qualifications as well. So advisors had a huge, there was, it raised the bar massively in terms of the qualifications advisors had to get. So that was also something that came in at the same time as RDR, as well as part of RDR. And at the time, there was loads of fears that loads of advisors would leave because they wouldn't do the qualifications and they wouldn't, their business models wouldn't operate. They couldn't work under the commission ban that was coming into effect. But that didn't really materialize. In fact, advisors kind of have really prospered in the 12 years that's happened since then. And so in terms of, well, sorry, Ryan, you go.
Well, our coffee bowl is kind of planning to do the same, you know, the commission-based versus advice fee debate. The trend's quite prevalent still in South Africa about pushing policies and not necessarily giving the best advice that the client needs. In your experience, when that regulation came into play, did it actually change that behavior? You mentioned not a lot of people dropped out of the industry, but did it actually make a difference?
It did make a difference. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the new Model Advisor title, actually, we started in 2005 or 6, I think, that started publishing magazines. And a big part of the early days of the new Model Advisor title was appealing to fee-based advisors who weren't charging commissions, who were just charging an advice fee, and kind of building this community. So a lot of these guys would say, a lot of the advisors we speak to these days say that, you know, we stopped charging commission before RDR. We went, you know, ahead of the game. We moved before the FCA. So, you know, lots of firms didn't change anything because they were already not charging, not paying, not taking commissions. But then lots of firms were, and you know, removing the commissions did massively change things. And I think it definitely caused like a professionalization of the sector. It just, it really raised the bar, and it had a massive impact. And I think it's got to have a say. It's got to have a positive impact. I mean, the only kind of downside you have in the UK at the moment is that we have a huge advice gap, in quotation marks, whereby the statistics show there's only 8 or 9% of the UK adults receive an ongoing advice service. And I think, you know, many people argue this has in part been a consequence of RDR because it just means that advisors are more focused on the high-end clients with, you know, £500,000 plus in the bank accounts because they're going to make the most fees out of these people. Whereas people below that kind of asset level, they're not, they just don't, they don't have advisors who are kind of knocking on their door selling funds anymore. So that there's kind of this big cohort in the middle, well, in the middle and below, and the bottom really, in terms of pension size, who are just not being serviced by advisors. So that's a big issue, and that's something that people are still talking about now as being a kind of long-lasting consequence from RDR.
Well, we don't even have the RDR yet, and the advice gap is a problem with us. Alan Gray just released a survey maybe a month or so ago that we wrote about. Our advice gap is a bit smaller than yours, but only 11%, so 2% better than you. But still, it's the same problem with the fee structure. We focus on high net worth individuals. However, there's a growing middle class, you know, civil servants, policemen, teachers, you know, that have pension funds, that have a need for gap cover and have savings accounts. So I wonder how we are going to cater for this new stream of business when that part of the business actually kind of diminishes or die, or that wealth is not transferred to their children or even kind of just blown by their kids.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I think in the UK as well, the big problem we have is that advisors are very old. No, don't want, sorry to kind of be so blunt. I think the average is 58, the average ages. So we have an elderly advice population. The guys are kind of, I mean, a lot of them are working into their 70s, which is amazing. But they're retiring. We don't have this new cohort coming up to kind of replace them, which is going to potentially mean the situation gets worse. Rowan, can I just jump? So Kofi, will this ban commission payments in South Africa or?
Yes, in essence, it will. They will still be kind of commission on products like short-term insurance and things like that, but that will fall outside of the scope of traditional
Yeah.
advice.
So you can still be paid commission on insurance
Exactly,
products
but
in the
any kind
UK.
of things that fall into a longer-term insurance or risk benefits or that advice, commission is,
or
a,
investments.
Is a no-go. Yeah, investments is a no-go. Funny enough, it's not just going to be in investment fees, or some of them are even considering giving, well, charging for advice per hour. You know, sometimes people have more holistic requirements or more technical estate planning requests and things like that. And South Africa is also a very unique market. We have things like beneficiary trusts and things that is connected to it's our legacy issues, and they take quite a long time to kind of distinguish and put together. So that's even becoming an option and would be very much appropriate under the new regime.
And what's the kind of what's the response been like so far? Like, what have advisors and pension funds and fund managers been saying about it?
The more established folk, you know, this is 10 years coming. They've kind of been
10 years.
Yeah, 10 years. We like to take our time in South Africa. We very, very, we're time consuming process, regulatory process.
Yeah,
it
goes to
so many levels. Yeah.
Have
already started to prepare for it. I think it's going to be the smaller, more kind of mom and pop shops that are going to be kind of shocked or their feet kicked out underneath them, because that's part of their livelihood. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot of kind of merger and acquisition activities, people selling out, you know, smaller firms getting together to make sure that their books are growing. And also kind of to share this compliance burden, because the compliance burden is going to grow. You know, it's not just about the commission split or the commission changing commission structures. There's a lot of new things that are coming through in the new coffee bowl, you know, about advice, about payments, about education, about, and we'll talk about this in a second, about what you suppose, how you educate your clients, how you influence, things like that. So there's a lot of new boxes to tick. Mm. And if you're a small firm and you have to spend so much time on ticking boxes, how much time do you actually have giving advice and earning a livelihood?
Mm. It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think one consequence of RDR in the UK, I think we talked about this earlier, that what you actually saw was the big institutions, they stopped offering advice. So the banks and the insurers kind of pulled out of the market and actually opened the door for the small businesses to kind of prosper. And that's who are dominating the market now, the smaller firms. And I guess part of that has been just a consequence of it, because, you know, for banks, they want to sell their products. They want to sell their funds that they're making or whatever, or they have partnerships with whichever fund manager. So for them to kind of lose the ability to charge commission was a big, you know, big moment for them, and actually was kind of one of the things that pushed them out of the market. But what we have seen this kind of a rise of the small IFA in the market, and that they've kind of dominate things really at the moment. There's thousands of them, and it's like 5,000 advice firms in the UK. A lot of them are small businesses. So in a way, we've seen the opposite, but maybe you'll see a different net result.
You mentioned it. It's actually going, I've spoken to some of the big institution, the guys with the life licenses and kind of the guys that are grown out of the banks. And this split between independent and tied brokers or advisors is 40-60 in to the side of independent. Mm-hmm. And they're also kind of splitting out their asset management arms into different different departments. Mm-hmm. So that they can actually, their brokers can actually buy or get business from any asset manager or product provider that they want that's best for the client. And that's even before the coffee bowl is coming into play. So I definitely think we're going that way. And I think we've learned a lot from what's going on in the UK, because a lot of these big financial institutions, banks, the life offices do have branches here. So they kind of learn from here and then kind of just transport it over the ocean.
Yeah. I mean, there's loads of companies like Old Mutual and 91.
Sanlam is another one.
Sanlam, yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Let's talk about our regulatory renaissance is a lot about major digital transformation, which is underway. Your regulation has been in play for a long time, but what's going on in the digital space from a regulatory perspective and from a practical perspective?
I mean, there's quite a lot. It's not an area we cover huge amount, because our readers are financial advisors, and a lot of them are dealing with kind of retiree clients and things. But I think the digital space is much more about the young investors And things like crypto and kind of some of the trading apps that have come up, which I'm sure are present in South Africa as well. I mean, I think we had this big boom during lockdown, didn't we, when people were at home and they had some cash to, they had nothing to do with else to do with their money, so they were, you know, buying crypto ETFs and buying trading stocks all the time and things like that. So I think there was this big boom that happened, but it has kind of continued post lockdown. I think the FCA were probably quite slow to catch up to what was going on here, but now we're seeing much more talk from the FCA around this sphere. I guess there's different things going on. I mean, on crypto, the FCA have kind of this. They have banned various crypto products. I think they have banned crypto derivatives. That's still in place. But they have opened the door to, it was kind of a couple of weeks ago, they announced that exchange traded note cryptos would be allowed to sold to retail investors. So they're kind of opening the door to crypto kind of slowly, but they're also a bit concerned about, you know, the consumer impact, I think, as well. And then on the finfluencer space, this is an area the FCA are getting a bit hot on in the UK. They've basically issued various warnings in the last few years that around finfluencers who are selling financial products through TikTok or whatever social media channel. And the FCA kind of warning that these guys aren't regulated to give advice, even though it looks like they are in many cases. And often I think they're taking, you know, big commission payments to sell certain products or promote certain products, which is then not being disclosed to the kind of young people who are watching these TikTok videos and things. So the FCA, there was a period where they're putting out lots of warnings about this. And then it probably looked like some people weren't heeding these warnings because there was 20 influencers who were interviewed under caution by the FCA last year. And then a few months ago, the FCA announced that 7 kind of Z-list celebrities, people who are kind of very low down the celebrity chain, like reality TV stars, say stars in quotation marks, the FCA actually opened an investigation. So they started criminal proceedings against for promoting certain investments online and breaking certain laws, or allegedly breaking certain laws around this. So there's a big trial of these kind of mini celebrities in the UK, I think scheduled for next year, which is going to have a big impact. The other thing on the influencer front, though, that the FCA have said, had a meeting with MPs a few weeks ago, where they were basically saying the problem they've got is a lot of the influencers are based overseas. A lot of them based in places like Dubai and Bali or whatever, and they're making videos from their bedrooms or the hotel rooms out there. And it's difficult for the FCA to do anything about that because they're overseas. So I think it was like last week the FCA announced a regulatory initiative with various different regulators from different countries around the world to try to kind of crack down on this, because they told MPs in the UK that this is a big problem they can't really do anything about.
It is very interesting if you just think that the digital tax debate about who pays VAT or who pays income taxes across the world with all the big tech, it's how many years later and they still haven't solved that problem. So it's going to be very interesting how they're going to tackle this whole influencer space. If I was the king of the world or the president or the head of the FCA in South Africa, I'd just ban all kind of marketing from anybody famous. You know, if you don't invest in it, if you don't understand, you're not allowed to punt it. Full point. But I'm a bit of an extremist, I was told by my colleagues. But let's go back to crypto. Last year in South Africa, crypto was legally recognized as a financial asset, number one. And secondly, our FCA regulator created a license for crypto traders or crypto advisors. I think there were about 100 applications, 20 of them have been approved. And just before we came in studio, we talked about us going more red tapey and you guys going in the opposite direction. So from a regulatory perspective, where is the FCA standing about regulating, you know, the trading and the advice and the access to crypto products? Because it's not going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, I think their position is a little bit muddled. I think in one respect they're kind of pulling back, and the other they're kind of they're trying to allow more things. I can't see a situation where the FCA are going to give license, allow financial advisors to sell or to advise on crypto products. I think it's just too risky a field for them, and I think they just wouldn't want to see that happening. And I think as well, advisors, there's no call from advisors to say we want to advise on crypto. I mean, my colleague, one of the reporters, Joe, did a piece when he spoke to advisors the other day asking about crypto, and they're all just still saying, look, we don't understand this, we don't want to advise on it, even though clients are asking about it more and more. So I don't think the FCA are ever going to get to a point where they're going to allow investment advisors to advise on crypto. I think it's much more a digital field in the UK, where people go on to trading apps, trading platforms, and crypto exchanges to purchase the products. And then I think the FCA, the thing they're doing at the moment is just, working out which ones should and shouldn't be allowed, because it's a whole complex sphere of, crypto ETFs and crypto derivatives and whatever, stable coins and things like that. So I think they're looking through the product set they've got now. I mean, I think the big thing, and obviously in America, is allowing cryptos into ETFs, which has caused a huge, spike in prices of cryptocurrencies around the world. And I think it's become much more of a mainstream asset out there. So I guess that's probably the FCA probably looking at the colleagues in the US to see whether or not that should be allowed at the moment.
Jack, I'm going to talk about two articles that were published on your website recently. The one is about name and shame.
You're
going to
test me now, Ryan.
I don't test your knowledge. Some homework. There was the name and shame rule for firms under investigation was scrapped. And another thing was the diversity disclosure rules were also shelved. Maybe you can just tell my listeners or viewers, I keep on correcting myself today, a little bit about that, because in South Africa, name and shame has become quite an ineffective tool, especially for people who forget or don't do their homework or don't do their compliance activities. And diversity, especially the transformation and gender in South Africa, is quite important, taking our history into consideration. Why is the FCA going in that direction?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they're kind of going in different directions and changing directions quite a lot of the time. So the name and shame things, look, this was a couple of years ago, the FCA came out and said, we want to explore being more public in terms of saying, if we've got an investigation into some company, we want to be more public and say this company is under investigation because of X, Y, Z reason. I think, in years gone by, the FCA was often criticised for not being public about some of these investigations, for keeping things under wraps until they issued like a public enforcement notice against a firm or an individual. They would be often very, you'd ask them, is this company under investigation? And they'd say, look, we can't confirm or deny this or whatever. So they'd obviously be very, they're very closed in terms of disclosing things like this. And the FCA, as you said, came out, the clues in the name and shame, they came out with this idea that they would be more public, which kind of could create more transparency, and also would be an effective deterrent to say, well, if you go under investigation, we can then name you, and then that's potentially going to put people off, kind of breaking the rules or committing bad practice. So they came out with this plan, and there was huge pushback. So the industry kind of they pushed back hard on this, and a lot of MPs as well did as well, because I think the idea was that if a firm is under investigation, it might not have done. It might be found at the end of the day to have not. Like, it could result in no action. The FCA drop a lot of investigations. A lot of those are because of resources issues. But the FCA do drop a lot of investigations because maybe they find the firm in question wasn't committing as bad as behaviour as they thought they were initially. So I think there was this idea of innocent until proven guilty, and that should be kind of at the forefront of what the FCA does. So the plans were dropped. I guess the other thing to say, and we can talk about, I think it kind of follows on from the diversity point you mentioned, everyone, is that the FCA announced they were dropping these plans at the same time as there has been a fairly recent move towards deregulation in the UK. This has very much been instigated by our Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor and the government. They're pushing for deregulation from the FCA because they want to kind of foster economic growth, and that's part of their ideas there. I mean, there are various different other political things going on in the background, but there's this push, and I think the name and shame plans was going to be more red tape, potentially higher bar of regulation. So that was kind of one of the things that fell in the bonfire of this kind of deregulation mode. The diversity point, that was very much the same category. I mean, the FCA have been big on diversity for the last kind of 5 years. I think really 2020 and 2021 was when we saw a lot of talk around this from the FCA and how they want to improve the diversity policies within financial services firms. And I think, in the UK, we have seen a pushback against that in the last 12 months or so. I mean, I think a lot of it potentially was coincided around Donald Trump's victory in the US elections last year. And, you know, that held in this kind of push back away from ESG and diversity policies. And I think in the UK, we saw kind of like a bit of a tail end of that in terms of many of our policies around these, in terms of corporate and regulatory initiatives around this, were also pushed back, have been pushed back on in the last kind of few months. So I think the diversity, the move away from kind of diversity requirements, have been a combination of a deregulation push and also potentially maybe having a little bit of a Trump factor, although that is a very cynical potential way of looking at it. But certainly I think it's something, it's a view that isn't, I'm not the only one saying it, basically.
Jack, just before we came into studio, we talked, we compared a few notes, and I was telling you that the FECA was cleaning house and catching up on a lot of things that were gathering dust in the storeroom. And with the new commissioner that was appointed about 2 years, he's doing a great job. Do you think the FECA is doing enough? The FCA is doing enough in protecting vulnerable customers, fueling enough investment or savings, or creating a pipeline of new advisors, financial education, all that that public mandate that is actually like the bigger picture that's quite important in the bigger scheme of things.
Well, I mean, I think the FCA, I mean, it is in a tough space at the moment because it has this kind of new mandate to foster economic growth. At the same time, it's got this kind of protecting consumers mandate. So it's kind of got to do, it's got to allow, you know, promote growth and help companies grow and stop and not be like a blocker on their growth plans, at the same time that it's also got to look after consumers and protect consumers. So having those kind of double mandate requirements is a difficult ask for them. Do I think they're doing enough? I mean, I think they have improved. I think things are better there. There was a period, I think, a few years ago where things were really bad there. They were making a lot of mistakes, things like scams not being caught, you know, whistleblowing intelligence not being acted upon. I think maybe we've seen less of that in the last 2 years or so. There's still mistakes they make, there's still errors, and we still report on certain kind of failings there. I think there was always going to be certain failings. You know, someone asked me from the FCA a few years ago, you know, do you expect us to stop every scam? Mm. And that was like a difficult question because, you know, they can't be perfect. But I think things have improved there. I think that the challenge they're going to have going forward is, and they've been quite public about this, saying, you know, this kind of new growth mandate they've got from the government is going to mean there's going to be more risk in the financial system because they're moving to more of a lighter touch regulation. And that is going to mean there's going to be some blow ups, there's going to be some failings on their behalf and, you know, the companies they regulate, obviously. So they were quite open in saying this is a trade off we're going to have to come to terms with, I think probably potentially kind of forewarning the public about some terrible, you know, scandal that blows up in the next couple of years. So I think, yeah, watch this space, I'd say, on that front.
Let's move up the scale to policymakers. You know, you've just gone through a huge regime shift after the elections, and there's a lot of proposals around pension fund reform. If you speak to some of your sources and your readers or advisors, anyway, concerned about these new pension fund reform proposals, or what are the thoughts out there?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point as well. So this is another kind of this kind of growth agenda that the government are pushing on financial services. One of the things they're looking at doing is getting pension funds in the UK to invest more in UK companies. Because I think they found there's only like 3% allocation to, I think it was always under 5%. Oh yeah, it was about 3% allocation to UK companies among the big pension funds, or amongst all pension funds, I think collectively in the UK. So one of the things that the Chancellor, the government, and has kind of instigated is this push to get pension funds investing more in UK assets. And so far, I mean, it's very early days. Like, they're just announcing policies around this. The idea they've got, I think, like 20 odd pension funds to sign up to a voluntary code that they would invest at least 5% of their assets in UK kind of startup companies, UK private assets, and then 10% in UK companies, I think. So they'd signed up to this code, but not everyone did. And then the idea, the government had basically said that if pension funds don't do this voluntarily, we've got this backstop where we can introduce legislation that's going to mandate that they do it, basically. So saying, please do it, sign up to do it voluntarily or we'll force you to do it, basically. So there's this kind of push at the moment. And I think what we're hearing from pension funds, certainly a lot of people within the pension industry, is they're pushing back against this kind of the idea that it could be forced into doing this. They like to do things on their own terms, and a lot of them have concerns about investing in UK companies too much because, you know, they want global allocations. So that is an interesting tension that's happening at the moment. And I mean, yeah, I think it was interesting though when you were saying in South Africa there's a much higher allocation to South African homegrown assets.
Absolutely. I think that the biggest investors in our stock exchange are institutional, not necessarily just pension funds. We've got the unit trust as well, but they're predominantly institutional.
Yeah.
The biggest pension fund in Africa is our government employee pension fund, and the state asset manager, the PIC, is probably the two biggest decision makers in the country. What's quite interesting, our pension fund legislation is way more enabling than prescriptive. Mm. We have limits, so you can only do so much offshore and so many in alternative assets, and quite recently, they increase the limit that you can invest in infrastructure.
Yeah.
Especially around...
So that's overlapping.
Yeah,
what's going
so
on
especially
UK.
Around renewable energy, because we are kind of in an energy crisis, but also kind of a state infrastructure development. We are a tad behind that, and the government is struggling to kind of stimulate the economy. And people say, I save in a pension fund, why can I not see the investment that I save in, like around me, and pensioners or members of pension funds are becoming more vocal. I want to see my money work for me, and the pension funds are listening, and governments enabled that through policy, which I think is quite a positive thing.
Mm. I guess we're seeing like an increasing politicization of kind of regulation and pension money. Certainly, in the UK and South Africa, it's probably something that's going on. I mean, obviously, in the UK, it's quite funny because the FCA always say, you know, we're independent of government, you know, we're an independent regulator. But realistically, a lot of the time, the government are saying, you know, do this and do that, and the FCA are kind of following suit, really.
As a last question before we end up this very fascinating concept, because I can talk to you for hours, is an interesting trend that's happening is that the FECA's scope or mandate is about to broaden. You know, it's always just been investments, pension funds, things like that, maybe a little bit of risk cover. But, you know, it almost seems like debt management, health cover is always kind of coming to that cell blanket, because holistic advice across all kind of, you know, how long you live, longevity, are you healthy, what your underwriting going to be, risk being, it all connected in some way or form. Is that holistic view coming from the regulator as well, or from the advice community at all?
In the UK?
Yeah.
So in the UK, there are, you know, most financial products fall under the FCA's remit. There are certain things that fall outside of it. I think, debt management is not regulated by the FCA in the UK. And there's certain other products. I mean, crypto is one of those grey areas where there's some of crypto activity is unregulated, some of it is. So that's kind of one of the grey areas there. I think most financial products, and certainly in terms of insurance, in terms of investments and pensions, most of these things are regulated by the FCA. I mean, it's interesting because occasionally you'll get calls to bring certain new sectors into the FCA's orbit. And while you can see that being like a good idea, the FCA often say, well, look, we can't do everything and we only have a certain amount of resources. And if you stretch us too far, then it's just going to be impossible to work. So the thing that's coming through at the moment is buy now, pay later, which is, I don't know if you have this in South Africa. It's like basically people can buy whatever clothes, whatever online through credit agreements.
They call it lay-by in South Africa. Yeah.
There's a big company called Klarna, which is really big here. And particularly amongst young people, so they'll you know, go online, and instead of spending £50 on a new dress, they'll just, you know, they'll pay over like a 6 month period. They'll pay in installments, things like that. So that is the moment is being brought under the FCA's remit into the regulators. And I think part of that is this kind of coming back to that point we were talking earlier about the kind of young people potentially being victims of some of these kind of influences and things. I mean, certainly young people have been getting into lots of debt with these buy now, pay later credit agreements. So that's the new thing that's coming under the FCA's orbit. We'll see how that goes. But certainly there are more things being added to the FCA's plate all the time, I think.
Thank you, Jack. This has been a fascinating conversation. We're definitely going to continue it outside of the studio. To all my listeners, viewers, and I'm going to correct myself still a lot while I'm here in the UK, thank you very much for tuning in to this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uster, and my very, very talented producer, Vera Loba de Silva, from this, well, the CityWise Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms, including Iona.fm, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. We also have a library full of multimedia content on our website, so please don't forget to register and go check that out. And if you have any questions on what was discussed today, please reach out and do so. And with that, until next time, goodbye.